CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we have an article published by chiefexecutive.net. 54% of CEOs say top spot is more complex than they expected, and they feel isolated from their staff. And this is an article written in by J.P. Donlan. A new survey from RHR International reveals that over half of CEOs, 54%, feel the job was not what they originally expected and feel that and half feel isolated in their role. First-time CEOs are particularly susceptible to this isolation, with nearly 70% saying it negatively affects their performance. Although the study did not link complexity and isolation, it isn't hard to surmise that they may be linked, and why it may explain rapid turnover, particularly in financial services and technology. Now consider the departure of Yahoo's Carol Bartz and HP's Leo Apotheker. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Neither could get their respective organizations motivated to achieve a turnaround. HP chairman Ray Lane blamed Apotheker's sense of unreal financial projections and botched communications with senior management and Wall Street. Both were isolated from reality, and no doubt the pace of technology change was gaining on them. To some degree, isolation is just part of the job. A CEO can share only so much with his colleagues before he's open to favoritism or is ill-advised by those who have or may have their own agendas. The board may be an excellent sounding forum, but here again, a CEO must be prudent. By admitting doubts, does he or she leave himself vulnerable to board members who expect him to have all the answers? It's a tricky position that can isolate the best managers. Interestingly, the RHR International study found that of those who report this feeling, 61% believe isolation does hinder their performance, and that first-time CEOs are particularly susceptible to this isolation, with nearly 70% saying it negatively affects their performance. Now, not mentioned in the study is whether or not CEOs seek the company of their peers to combat this. If a leader can't share sensitive stuff with, say, a lead director or a non-executive chairman, the best advice can come from a fellow CEO from a different industry or sector to avoid conflicts. Chances are he or she is facing his or her own demons, and because they have no connection to your company, they may be the best to give you honest opinions. Well, thank you for that article. And moving on today in the show, I am very pleased to have as a guest today Marion Powers. Marion is on the faculty of the Kellogg School of Management's Allen Center for Executive Education at Northwestern University. She specializes in teaching financial reporting and analysis to executives. Since 1987, Marion has designed and delivered customized finance and accounting training for numerous corporations and organizations. Marion earned her PhD in accounting from the University of Illinois at Urbana. In addition to serving on the accounting faculty of the Kellogg School, Marion has also taught at the University of Illinois at Chicago and the Lake Forest Graduate School of Management. She is also co-author of several college accounting textbooks and in-depth cases on financial analysis. The Text and Academic Authors Association chose financial accounting as recipient of the 1998 Textbook Excellence Award, and in 2008, Principles of Accounting received the McGuffey Award. Her research has been published in the Accounting Review, the International Journal of Accounting, Issues in Accounting Education, the Journal of Accountancy, the Journal of Business, Finance and Accounting, Studies at Managerial and Financial Accounting, and Financial Management, among others. Well, my goodness, what a host of things that you've done in your life, Marion. Welcome to the show.
Lorraine, thank you very much.
Well, this is indeed a pleasure, Marion. We're going to have a lot to talk about today, but what I'd like to do is to start at the beginning. Some of our guests have CFOs have their first job has been as a gymnast or as a newspaper boy. One of our entrepreneur CFO guests sold frogs at the age of five. What was your first job?
Well, my very first job was a clerk in a supermarket. And I started at the age of 14.
What were you doing? Were you stacking shelves and on the counter?
Yes, and working at the register, at the checkout, when people would come with their purchases.
And, now, did you learn any lessons from then that have carried on through your life?
I would say that watching the numbers, I had to always make sure my register balanced at the end of the day, or I had some explaining to do. So I guess there was always some affinity with the numbers from early on.
Wonderful. Well, so how did you get from being in the check register to here today and at the Kellogg School of Business?
Well, when I first went to college, my thought was that I would be going into the fashion industry, quite separate from where I landed. But while I was there, you know, I knew I was in business school to learn the skills to run a business. And while I was there, I found that I was good at the numbers. I really enjoyed the quantitative side of the business studies. And that led me to specializing in accounting. And I had taken a job while I was in school with one of the large public accounting firms. And it wasn't suiting me well. It wasn't a good fit for my skills and what I wanted to accomplish. So I had the opportunity to go on to graduate school. And was there I discovered that I really enjoyed teaching and really enjoyed communicating more about the financial information and what do the numbers mean and kind of demystifying and decoding what the numbers are all about. Now, so with that, I pursued a PhD.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the PhD. There are not too many people in this world that have a PhD, let alone a PhD in accounting. I've done some pretty hairy debits and credits in my life, and most CFOs perhaps would think, oh my goodness, this is our day job as well. Do we want to study in it? But what do you do in a PhD in accounting?
Well, with a PhD, your main goals are really twofold. One is to do research that advances the understanding of the discipline, and the second thing is to obviously train others in your discipline, in the teaching side. So it's a combination of both research. A PhD is usually necessary to gain the statistical skills, the quantitative analysis skills that are needed to publish an academic journals.
And did you do a thesis as part of that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So wow us. What was your theme for the thesis?
The thesis was on, this was back in the day when segment reporting was just being required. And I went through thousands of footnotes, hand-collecting data on segment information to learn whether or not you could assess the riskiness of the firm overall by quantifying the risk of the parts to see if it corresponded to the risk of the whole. And I was using some finance models to test that theory. And the answer was yes, it was possible. And the riskier, there was ways to diversify the risk with the different types of segments, but it was very clear that there was a linkage there.
So from risk to finishing up your PhD in accounting, and you teach at a couple of different universities today, but your main core is with Kellogg School of Management with the
Correct.
Allen Center. Tell us a little bit about what is your typical day? I understand that from your experience delivering executive education to non-financial executives, that's got to be a challenge. I actually do a little bit of that myself here in the Atlanta area for some of the universities. And very often we find that business owners and executives may not have been able to take the time to do any accounting classes or finance classes, and yet they're running businesses, and a main core of having a business that's going to be effective is having the numbers right.
Lorraine, you're absolutely right. When I have the privilege of being in the classroom with executives or working with a particular company, these are usually folks that have already proven themselves in their own area of specialization. They're, whether it's sales or marketing, advertising, human resource, IT, R&D, even accounting and finance, all across that spectrum, these are folks that have risen up within their organizations because of success in usually one dimension. And now they have positions of responsibility, and they need to be able to ask the right questions about the numbers. Most non-financial executives do not want to know how the numbers are created. They don't want to know, you know, any of the details of debits and credits. But what they want to know is, why do I need to know this, and so what does it mean? So that they feel like they could confidently participate in a dialogue, whether it's at a corporate meeting, a one-on-one conversation with the CFO, that they can really ask the right questions and know that when they ask those questions, they're not shooting in the dark, but that they really have an understanding. So when I work with executives, I usually have them bring their own financial statements, and I say, okay, so let's learn the strategies for asking the right questions about the numbers. And I can do this because the strategies are universal. They work across industries, and they work across geography. It's just amazing. And so, one of my pure joys of being in the position that I am is that I can see the light bulb go on, and I can see the confidence build, and I can see them begin to apply the skills almost immediately and realize that, you know, we've just stripped away this veil that was kind of keeping them from getting to the next level, and making them better stewards of the capital that they have, that they're responsible for. And so it's, I think that's one of the main benefits that I derive from it. But the other thing that I derive is it's a two-way street. One of the things that keeps me in this particular part of academia is that when folks come to my class, they are asking questions that indicate to me what the business issues are that they're facing. So that, in turn, gives me an idea of what the burning issues are. That is something that I can take into my research and then bring that back to the classroom.
You know, it's
so
interesting.
It's a win-win situation. I think it's really a marvelous dynamic between those that are in the business community and those that are in the academic community.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, Marianne. In my work environment, I've been in board-level executive meetings where I've been preparing the financials and delivering them either to the board or the senior executive management, and that perhaps might be in some regards a peer conversation, in some regards it might have been earlier in my career. And I remember at one point a lady who was the CEO of the company, and she pulled me aside as we left the meeting, and I talked about the impact of depreciation on the financials for the quarter. And she pulled me aside, and she kind of looked right and left and said, don't really want anybody else to know, but I want to go to lunch with you. And a little bit before the lunch appointment, I got an email from her assistant saying, bring with you literally the basics of what fixed assets and depreciation were. And over lunch, we had a little bit of a lesson as to what depreciation was. And what I find with executives, it surprises me that sometimes, and in fact very often, they've grasped the complex areas, but yet basic things like accruals accounting, that is the foundation upon which we work, are confusing.
Lorraine, that's absolutely right. that's absolutely right. I've had that same experience myself.
It's very interesting to me that some of what we consider to be basic in accounting and would be the first steps of learning and education, they've almost run past there, and in their speed to get to the end on the marathon, they've figured out financial market value, fair market value, financial aspects of economics, NPV. I mean, they may have a very fine-tuned education in some of the more complex areas, but very often in teaching executives, you do need to bring it down to a base level.
And it's, I think, one of the key concepts that we as accountants maybe take for granted because it's so ingrained in what we know about the discipline, is the difference between earnings and cash, that earnings are not cash. And, you know, your discussion of depreciation is just one of those key variables that clearly articulates why the two are not the same. But that's a basic foundational concept that, you know, I really have to, you know, very early on in our discussions, get that clear in folks' minds to take away that ambiguity so they see the value of each of the financial statements and what they add to the mix of understanding about a company's financial health.
So, Marion, take that one step further. From your experience delivering these lessons to non-financial executives, CFOs deal with the head of sales, the head of marketing, the head of legal, the head of operations. What lessons might the CFOs find useful to know from what you've picked up?
We as accountants and financial types, we have this sea of financial information. We create reports with potentially hundreds of lines of information. And probably the most important thing that I hear from the non-financial folks is, what of this do I really need to know? And so I would say it's the keep it simple principle. We need to get it down to the basic elements and what really drives value, and help me understand what these three or four levers are, or however many levers there are, financial metrics that the CFO deems is really critical to the success of the organization financially, help them really get that and make that the central focus of any reporting system that you do. Now, it doesn't mean you wouldn't give the detail or make the detail available, but keep it at a high level. They get overwhelmed with getting pages of spreadsheets and not knowing where to begin.
So do you think that the CFO's role in part is education, or should the CFO have somebody like you on their dial tone to say, hey, I'm going to send my head of sales to you?
I think it can work both ways. I think it's some of both, because you want to have that ability when, you know, not everyone can afford to take the time to attend classes. Their schedules don't permit it. So the CFO, I think, definitely has a part to play here. And if nothing else, to reinforce what is learned in the classroom. I've had CFOs come to me that are in my classes. We do a combination of topic-specific and then broad general education. So someone that's been out for 20, 25 years come back to the classroom to get up to date on all the disciplines, not just finance. So very in that kind of a program, you will have CFOs in the audience. And I have had CFOs come to me afterwards and say, listening to the class talk about, and again, it's a wide variety of skill sets in the room in terms of expertise and talent and ability, but come back to me and say, I can see that, you know, what people don't understand much more clearly by watching and perceiving the dialogue, but this particular person I'm thinking of now is a CFO of an electric utility, and she said, I can see what I need to do to better communicate this information across the organization and how I can simplify what I do. And I felt like I was successful on both fronts. That wasn't literally my message, because that wasn't the main thing, but these were things that she took away from it, and as a result, she changed what she was doing within her own company and the way she communicated information across the organization.
Wow. Well, Marion, taking that one step further in terms of the research that you've done, you've published several research studies focused on identifying the financial characteristics of high-performance companies, companies that are doing very well and appear to be sound. How did you identify the high-performance companies, just as a starting point?
Oh, my goodness. You know, that is a question that has lots of answers. I mean, if you were to look to a classic book by Tim Collins called Good to Great, you might say, oh, well, these are the characteristics of high-performance companies. But when I looked at that book, that was actually a challenge to me because I looked at it and said, what from a finance perspective is driving this, quote, greatness? And I could not see a real clear delineation in that particular study. I also knew from the executive education that people were not understanding what the most important numbers were. So one of the things I was hoping to discover in doing this research was to find out what were these characteristics. But how did I get to high performance? Well, you look at the general population, and even in business, believe that high performance is it comes and goes. It's a flame out. It comes very quickly, and then, you know, you're back to being in the pack with all the others in the industry. An example like might be, how many people had Razr phones, 10 years ago? Probably would have had 60% of a room raise their hand. Today, you ask anybody if you've got a Razr phone, they don't. So, you know, that's an example of flame out. You know, you've come, you had really good success, and then you weren't sustaining it. So we wanted to, and myself and some co-authors, wanted to discover what was sustainable success. So sustainable meant let's set a time frame, and we said for a 10-year period, what would constitute high performance over a 10-year period? And we went back to a very simple concept in the basics of finance as well as accounting, and that is let's earn a return above our cost. I mean, that's as simple as it gets. And so we said, how many of the firms? And we looked at tens of thousands of companies, and we asked that basic question to kind of say, okay, let's find out who's the potential for being a high performer. First of all, they have to earn a return above their cost. And I was amazed at the number of firms that do not do that. That was amazing to me that there were just, even over a 10-year period, companies couldn't sustain getting above their cost of capital. That's a whole other subject. But coming back to the high performers, we then looked within that group that did earn a return above their cost. We looked at what was the top, like, 10% of that group? What were the really, really exceptional ones? And those tended to be ones where they were earning 1.5 to 2 times their cost of capital. So really high performers. And that was purposeful because we wanted to compare this group with others in their industry to identify then what characteristics would be different about these really high performers compared to the others in the industry. So but to make sure that wasn't just an anomaly based on the way we calculated it, we said that we didn't want companies to shrink to greatness because you can take a measure and manipulate it so you can get within a group. You know, you can sell off assets and, you know, you can do things to make it look like your numbers look better. So we required these companies to at least grow at the rate of the economy that they were operating in. So in the U.S., that would be GDP. And then the other thing we looked at, again, because we wanted the analysis to be really sound and not have any confounding variables, is we looked at security prices. And we said, do the security prices behave in a manner consistent with the underlying economic financial performance? And if that was the case, then that was a good candidate. So that was how we selected our high performers. And from there, we were able to then contrast those companies with others within the same industry and say, so what's different about these companies?
So what insights did you glean from the financial characteristics of those high-performance companies?
Well, it was quite amazing. We did not start with a model saying, this is what we think the answer is. We instead said, let's take a myriad of financial ratios or financial metrics that are used across the industries and all the different ways they're customized. I like to say you can put 10 people, 10 finance and accounting people in a room, ask them to calculate debt-to-equity ratio, and you'll get 7 different answers. And that's because we have high degrees of customization about what we're going to include in the numerator and what we're going to include in the denominator. So what we did is we didn't predefine what this looked like. We simply said, let's put out all these possibilities and let the data tell us what the answer is. So we didn't come in with a priori expectation about what the result would be. And what we learned after looking at these many, many different variations of ratios is that there were 6 key numbers and 4 key ratios. And the amazing thing was that it didn't matter the economic cycle, good economic time, bad economic time, it didn't matter a lot of dimensions. But let me tell you what the 6 key numbers are. The 6 key numbers were revenue, net income, cash flows from operations, assets, liabilities, and equity. And if you think about that, that is at a very high level. Now, what ratios did came out of that? Well, the ratios that came out of that were profit margin, which is income over revenue. Now, an interesting thing about profit margin was that these were not customized measures. The statistics showed us that the net income result was the more telling number, that high-performance organizations generally do not have big bets. They don't take huge, big write-off surprises in their financial statements. If they have them, they take them. They tend to be modest. They are not any big surprise. And so that was a very interesting characteristic of these high performers. They consistently gave a good profit margin, and they got it from their core operating results. It wasn't the result of non-operating items. So the net income number was really closely tied to the operating income for these high performance organizations. There wasn't a huge disparity. There wasn't using gains on the sale of assets or something to cause that net income to reach a targeted number. So it was a really solid performance. The second measure that came out, which I think was asset turnover, and this is one that doesn't get a lot of press, it doesn't get a lot of publicity, it doesn't even get, you know, I think recognized in a lot of the financial reports that I see companies produce, both internally and externally. And if we think about this measure, asset turnover, it's comparing the revenue in the numerator with the average total assets in the denominator. And what that, you know, if we think about the definition of an asset, I mean, we have our legal definitions, our GAAP definitions. But if we just step back from a manager perspective and say, what's an asset? Well, it's an economic resource available to generate revenue. It's what I have. It's the land, the building, the equipment, the patents, the copyrights, the trademarks, the invent all the assets that we have in order to generate the revenue. So doesn't it make sense to take a look at the assets and see how well those assets produce revenue, top line? And so this is assessing the efficiency and effectiveness of the use of assets in generating revenue, and the high-performance organizations, once again, are statistically higher on asset turnover for their given industry and that compared to their peers that are not a high performer. So it was very, very telling.
That's an interesting ratio, and to your point, I don't see a lot of companies focusing on that whatsoever.
I know.
In fact, I don't see a lot of companies even calculating it.
Exactly. So this was very, you know, if we step back and see the larger picture, we say the value of the firm is in the flows. Well, what are the flows? They're the revenue flows, the resulting earnings flow, and then the ultimate cash flow.
Sure.
But it all starts with the assets and the people that deploy those assets. So in a way, it's a very logical progression that you would start with, okay, how well do we generate revenue from the assets? And then profit margin's a logical extension of that. How well do we manage our costs given the revenue that we've produced? So it's a good combination.
So do we then move into a cash focus for the third and four key ratios?
Yeah, the third one is financial risk, and that's debt to equity. And amazingly here was that of all the definitions of debt to equity ratio, where we could find statistically significant differences, was using total liabilities to total equity. Now, that flies in the face of so much that we do in finance, that we customize, we take this thing out, or we add this in, or we only look at borrowing, or we only look at... And really, what amazed us was that it was the total picture. It was looking at everything, not just looking at the little parts, but looking at all of the liabilities compared to all the equity, that really gave us the best statistical difference between the two.
That's interesting, because a lot of companies do try and talk about, you know, particular aspects of income, and they add this and they deduct that, and you know, free cash flow rather than cash flow from the cash flow statement, and then you end up having notes in the financial statements reconciling the company's free cash flow that they talk about in their earnings reports to the cash flow that is the GAAP cash flow. And you know, one could argue from a GAAP perspective, is that really necessary? And the other argument is, well, if that's what management use from an operating perspective, you've got to be able to use that comparison. But there's a lot of delineation between what we want to report as our numbers and what we use internally, which is what is used. So it's interesting that companies that were the high performers just are solid all round, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And you know what? Earnings per share didn't even show up as a variable that where there was statistical difference.
So what's the fourth ratio then?
The fourth ratio is cash flow yield.
Cash flow yield.
This is not one that many folks know about, but this is defined as the cash flows from operations, operating activities, just from the top third of the statement of cash flows, divided by the net income or the net earnings. It's comparing the accrual number with the underlying cash. And what we find is that high-performance companies have very low variance on a cash flow yield. It's not about the amount of cash. It's the consistency of delivering that cash that makes them a high performer. So, for example, a company might have $1.38 of cash flows from operations for every dollar of earnings 1 year. The next year have $1.40. The following year have $1.39, and the following year have $1.44. In other words, the variance of the numbers is very predictable. Why is that so key? Because it reduces the risk. Someone reading the financial report and looking at these numbers would then look at the relative riskiness, whereas I've seen, and we'll all see this, all we have to do is look at financial information of companies, and you'll see $6.57 of cash to dollar of income, and then you'll see $2.93, and then you'll see 97 cents, and then $1.42. Well, all that kind of volatility means that there's no easy way to forecast the cash flows from the earnings number. And as a result, this cash flow yield is an amazing measure, and it tells us so much. It's not one that we hear much about, but it's certainly one that I look at almost first when I don't know anything about a company. It's usually the first one I go to.
That's very telling. That really is. And when you go into companies and you help them, if you're looking at some kind of data statistic that they don't even recognize, I would imagine the conversations are quite interesting.
They are indeed. And what we learned is that this cash flow yield needs to be within a certain range. The healthy companies, the high-performing companies, not only have low variance, they tend to be in a set range. To have a cash flow yield of less than one, meaning you don't deliver a dollar of cash related to a dollar of earnings that you've reported, is usually an early warning sign.
And that can be a predictor of cash issues.
Well,
exactly. Looking at that in terms of the cash cycle, can you elaborate a little bit more on what is most important about the cash cycle?
Well, if we think about this difference in the cash flow yield, we start with net income and we reconcile the cash flows from operations. One of the major group of items that we're adjusting to bring us down to the cash flow number is the operating working capital. And the operating working capital is going to focus us in on the inventory levels, the receivables, and the payables, and other operating accounts as well. But the idea here is that we've learned from the high-performance organizations that, again, regardless of the economy, high-performance organizations have figured out their inventory system. They understand supply chain. They're executing well. They've streamlined. A good example of this, and I was just so amazed at their success with this, was Kraft Foods pre-Cadbury merger. They added almost $1 billion to their cash flow over a three-year period by streamlining the number of vendors that they were using for their, you know, tens of thousands of products. And they just systematically, every step of the way, you know, reevaluated their supply chain and looked at those relationships, where they could better create value by having more purchases with an individual supplier than to have these myriad of suppliers. And I think they reduced to about by more than a third their total number of suppliers, and that helped them streamline their costs as well. But it was just amazing to watch. The other thing that matters, and this is dependent on the economy, is the day sales outstanding. The day sales outstanding, of course, the ability to collect from our customers. In a good economy, companies across an industry don't differ. But within a difficult economy, the high performers are consistently better at the follow-up and all the things that are necessary to get that bill paid from their customers. So it's an interesting dynamic to see there. But inventory turns, I think, it's the hardest thing, I think, for finance to get their arms around. It takes so much cooperation on so many levels of the organization. It engages a lot more people. When we say, well, let's improve our day sales, finance can work with that, and maybe some input from sales or working with sales. But it doesn't take the depth and complexity that managing the inventory and improving that does. That takes a commitment on the part of the organization as a whole.
And I often find with inventory that a key component of that is many years perhaps in advance of the sales efforts, the purchasing and the marketing around what is going to be sold, and somewhat of a predictor of what the demand is going to be. For example, Apple. I would imagine that many people in the company had a predictor, but whether they expected the prediction of the number of sales that has come out. I mean, you almost can't be in a meeting these days without somebody having an iPhone and or an iPad. And I heard a statistic not so long ago that households that have one iPad or iPhone typically have 2 to 3 iPads or iPhones. And normally speaking, that kind of talks about an electronic junkie, but what they're essentially saying is once you're hooked, you're probably in a financial level to being able to afford multiples if you buy one, and thereby the family does. And so to your point in terms of some of the equipment, inventory in a high turnover equipment, an electronic technology market, things can go out of date very, very quickly.
Absolutely, absolutely. Technological obsolescence is definitely a risk.
So did you find that it matters about the industry the company operates in or what kind of country? I mean, for example, you mentioned Kraft Foods, and they have a lot of products that are, you know, everyday household eaten, products that we eat in our home. Were there companies that were high tech included in this? Were there companies that of any different industries?
Absolutely. In fact, it was across the industries. First of all, let me tell you about countries. When we did the studies initially, it was U.S. companies, but then we broadened it to include Australia. And in Australia, quite interesting, the high-performance industries weren't the same as the industries you find in other parts of the world necessarily. Of course, Australia had some high-tech in there. They had some service businesses. But they also had a lot in the mining industry. So that was a key dimension in Australia. But there were companies like Trans-Pacific and whatif.com, IINet, I'm trying to think of some of the others that we had from Australia, Coffee, Aquagold, Beach Petroleum, BHP Billiton. So these are energy companies, natural resource companies, MacArthur Coal. So very interesting. We go to India, on the other hand, we see the obvious ones. You've got Infosys, you've got Tata. Things related to infrastructure were really important, but certainly technology too. Pharma was big. Dr. Reddy, GlaxoSmithKline. Interestingly enough, Facham was a high-performance company in our sample, and that was one that we could not have predicted would have been that way because the nature of the fraud at Facham was that they were managing the cash flows. Usually, a fraud, if there isn't cash underlying it, is detectable with the cash flow yield. But with Facham, they were managing the cash flow numbers and falsifying the cash flow numbers, so it wasn't as discernible. That's kind of a side. And then in Europe, we had things like companies that manufacture escalators and moving walkways, clothing companies, beauty care companies, electronic companies, software companies. It's just a whole myriad of industries. So this was not exclusive to any particular geography or industry. It really cut across us. And what amazed us was regardless of these industries, it was the same six numbers and the same four ratios. It just was like, this is what it is. And it was just, you know, it was so in some ways satisfying how robust these measures are in comparing who's a high performer in an industry and who's not.
Well, Marianne, I know that we could talk in much, much more depth about these topics and the key ratios, and I've certainly learned a lot. For those that are listening that want to learn more, where is this research? Where can they find it?
Well, we have it posted. I have a website called needles-powers.com, and if they just click on what's new, they'll be able to see these research studies.
Needles as in pins and needles?
Correct.
Okay. Great. So www.needles-powers.com. And that
click on what's new.
Click on what's new. Great. Well, this is fabulous, fabulous research. And I'm afraid we're coming to the end of our show. But before we leave, Marianne, we have a tradition on the show to ask your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Oh, keep it simple. Identify what really matters and zero in on those few things that are most important to achieving the best results for the organization.
Well, that is a great tip. Certainly, whether you're delivering a complex message or a simple one, keeping it simple gives the ability for everybody to pick it up and understand. So thank you very much. And from a formal perspective, thank you for your time, for sharing your research. And I know that you've worked with co-partners in delivering some of this research. So thank you through you to them. Thanks for being our guest on the show, Marianne. For sharing your innermost thoughts of the role of the CFO. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And thanks also go to our contributor, to chiefexecutive.net for their article, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses. For more information about Delaney, please go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks. Go to National Association of Corporate Directors, Advancing Exemplary Board Leadership for Directors by Directors. You can see their website at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or know someone who would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web at info@cforadio.com. And thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.